Before our story starts, here's a promo for a sister podcast.
Yes, that's a very good special. Well, what do you
know about it? So, what do you do for fun?
Me? Oh, I play games.
Oh, I like games.
Whoa, no, I mean tabletop game. You know, with dice and stuff. You know, like D&D. Was it something I said?
Sir, I think you should leave.
Psst. Hey, buddy, don't worry. You'll find a Gamer's Haven around the corner.
The Gamer's Haven Podcast at gamershavenpodcast.com.
Hartman the Anarchist, or The Doom of the Great City, by E. Douglas Fawcett, illustrated by Fred T. Jane, published 1893. Chapter 7, The Captain of the Attila. 10 years had not rolled away for nothing. Still, the face which looked into mine vividly recalled my glimpse into the album in the little villa at Islington. Seated before a writing desk, studded with knobs of electric bells and heaped with maps and instruments, sat a bushy-bearded man with a straight, piercing glance and a forehead physiognomists would have envied. There was the same independent look, the same cool hardness that had stamped the mien of the youth, but the old impetuous air had given way to a cold, inflexible sedateness, far more appropriate to the dread master of the Attila. As I advanced into the room, he rose, a grand specimen of manhood, standing full 6 feet 3 inches in his shoes. He shook hands more warmly than I had expected, and motioned me tacitly to a seat. "You have heard about my mischance," I began tentatively. "I had hoped to meet you for an hour or so, but fear I have outstayed my welcome." I felt he was weighing me in the balance.
"I know probably more of that mischance than you do. Those luckless detectives were certainly embarrassing, but after all, they afforded us an incident. Of course, you can understand why we were bound not to leave you. And now that you are restored to vigor, are you sorry that you have seen the Attila?"
"On the contrary, I'm lost in wonder. But look, sir, at the cost of my privilege, these unfortunate men you refer to haunt me, and the purpose of this vessel, I must tell you, fairly appals me."
He listened approvingly. A man in his position can well afford to be tolerant. "Oh, the men. Such incidents must be looked for. Do generals dissolve into tears when 2 hostile sentries have to be shot? Do they shrink from the wholesale slaughter which every campaign entails? Nonsense, sir, nonsense."
"But your war is not against this or that army or nation, but against civilization as a whole."
I was determined to take the bull by the horns at the outset.
"You can scarcely justify that on those lines."
"Easily enough. The victory in view is the regeneration of man. The cost will be some thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, or millions of lives. The assailants are our small but legitimate army. We can say that our friends below are sincerely devoted to us and to our objects. Most of the ordinary soldiers of your princes have to be drummed into the ranks, either by want or the law. As to the cost, look back on history. How many wars in those annals have been waged for the service of mankind? On how many massacres has one ray of utility shone? Now you must admit that our ideal is a worthy one, even if unattainable. At the worst, we can shed no more blood than did a Tamerlane or a Napoleon."
"Certainly the ideal is a grand one, and might, if reliable, be worth the outlay. But how many of your crew appreciate the beauty?
Most, I will venture, love destruction for its own sake. Is Schwartz a reformer? Is Thomas?"
"My crew are enthusiasts, Mr. Stanley. Nay, if you like, fiends of destruction. Every man is selected by myself. Every man is an outlaw from society, and most have shed blood. They burn to revenge on the society the evils which they have received, or, given the appropriate occasion, would receive from it. In this way, I secure resolute, fiery, and unflinching soldiers. But do not mistake my meaning. I know how to use these soldiers."
"I understand. Regard me, according to Addison's simile, as the angel who guides the whirlwind. Look on these men, well, as you will. They are like the creatures generated in decaying bodies. They are the maggots of civilization, the harvest of the dragon's teeth sown in past centuries, the Frankenstein monsters of civilization which are born to hate their father. You have read Milton, of course. Do you recall the passage about sin and the birth of death who gnaws his wretched parents' vitals? It is the sin of this industrial age which has bred the crew of this death-dealing Attila."
"But are all these men here morally rotten? The man Schwartz, they call your shadow, is he a type?"
Not at all. Your friend Burnett, who has just startled the Kensington Notables, seems sound. He's a madman of the most reputable sort. There is another like him with us, a German of the name of Brandt, a philosopher recruited from the ranks of the Berlin Socialists. May I ask you two important questions? Say on. The world says you were once a mere fanatical destroyer. Have you changed your creed? You refer to my old days. Yes, you're right. I was then a pessimist and despaired of everything around me. And you became an anarchist, to revenge myself on the race which produced and then wearied me. I had no tutor but Schwartz, a faithful fellow, but a mere iconoclast. Our idea was simple enough. We were to raise, and let the future look to itself. Our mistake was in dreaming of even of moderate success. Immunity from the police was impossible, but those wasted days are past. He smiled ironically and bent his gaze on the wall, devouring, as it seemed, some especially pleasurable object. Following its direction, I became aware of a splendid sketch of the Attila, which constituted the sole aesthetic appanage of this singular sanctum. What a contrast it must have awakened between its present power and the abjectness of the fugitive of 10 years back. One more question. How do you propose to conquer now that you have the Attila? I cannot say as much yet, but understand, the day when the first bomb falls will witness outbreaks in every great city in Europe. We have some 12,000 adherents in London, many more in Paris, Berlin, and elsewhere. They will stir the tumult below. London is my objective to start with. During the tempest of bombs, the anarchists below will fire the streets in all directions, rouse up the populace, and let loose pandemonium upon earth. In the confusion due to our attack, order and precautions will be impossible. You horrify me. And the object? Is, as I repeat, to wreck civilization. If you are interested, Brandt will probably attract you. He lectures tomorrow on the upper deck. We are Rousseaus who advocate a return to a simpler life. But how is the new order to take shape? How a new system from chaos? We want no more systems or constitutions. We shall have anarchy. Men will effect all by voluntary association and abjure the foulness of the modern wage slavery and city mechanisms. But can you expect the more brutal classes to thrive under the system? Will they not rather degenerate into savagery? You forget the Attila will sail the breeze, and she will then have her fleet of consorts. What? You do not propose then to leave anarchy unseasoned? Not at once. The tradition will be far too severe. Some supervision must necessarily be excised, but, as a rule, it will never be more than nominal. Your ideal, Captain, amazes me. But the prospect, I admit, is splendid. Were you to succeed, I say at once that the return would well repay the outlay. I'm a socialist, you know, but I have felt how selfishness and the risks of reaction hampered all our most promising plans. The egotism of Democrats is voracious. It is the curse of our movement. But this scheme of supervised anarchy, well, in some ways it is magnificent. Still, it is only a theory. The Attila was once only a theory, rejoined Hartman. One word now, Mr. Stanley. I ask you neither to join us nor to agree with us. You are your own master, and should you dislike this tour, say the word, and at nightfall you shall be landed in France. If you elect to stay, well and good. I'm your debtor. Don't look surprised, for you have been a good friend of my mother, and least of all men, I forget debts. I only ask you to observe silence, respecting our conversations, which and never to interfere in anything you see in progress. Which is it to be? I elect to stay. I can do no good by leaving, and by staying I court an absolutely unique experience. Believe me too, Captain, I am not insensible to what you have said. Between the anarchist Schwartz and yourself yawns an abyss. Good. One thing, Captain. Could I find means to dispatch a letter to a lady? I added as I saw his eyebrows rise slightly. Certainly, if you conform to the rules voluntarily agreed upon. You are not one of us. You will not, therefore, object to the letter being read. I will spare you undue annoyance by formally glancing over it. The rule is reasonable enough, Captain, and requires no defense. It shall be given to one of the delegates when we touch land in Switzerland. A convention of importance is to be held there. But come, I will take you round the Attila. And striding by me, he passed out of the study. What was that land visible just now, Captain? I asked as we reached one of the stairways that led down into the vessel. Holland. The course has since been altered. We find the clouds are lifting, and not wishing to run too high, are making off towards the English Channel. Tonight we shall cross France, steering above the Havre, along the channel over the Seine, over Paris, Dijon, the Saône, and the Jura Mountains into Switzerland. I had intended to go to Bern, but have been forced to change my plans. We shall stop over a forest not far from Lake Leman, where some 50 delegates will meet us. After that, we return to London. For war?
For war. Down into the depths of the Attila we went, the spiral stair running down a deep and seemingly interminable well. On reaching the bottom, my conductor turned off into a passage brightly lit up with the electric light. A rumble and thud of machinery broke on the ear, and in a few seconds we stood in the engine room of the Attila. My readers are aware of the wonderful advances in electricity made in the early part of the 20th century, and I need not therefore recapitulate them here. In this mechanism of this engine room, there was nothing specially peculiar, but the appropriation of the best modern inventions left nothing to be desired. Electricity, according to the newly introduced method, being generated directly from coal, the force at the disposal of the aeronaut was colossal, and what was even more expedient, obtained for a trifling outlay of fuel. A short but very thick shaft, revolving with a great speed, led, I was told, to a screw without, and by the sides of this monster, two others of far humbler dimensions were resting idly on their rollers. I was now able to solve the riddle of the Attila's flight. The buoyancy of the vessel was that of an inclined plane driven rapidly through the air by a screw, a device first prominently brought into notice by the 19th century experiments of Maxim. The Attila, albeit light, was, of course, under normal conditions, greatly heavier than the quantity of air she displaced. Indispensable condition, indeed, of any real mastery over the subtle element she dwelt in. The balloon is a mere toy at the mercy of the gale, and its gas. The Attila seemed wholly indifferent to both. But desirous of probing the problem to the bottom, I put Hartman to the question. What would happen supposing that shaft broke, or the machinery somehow got out of order? Well, we should fall. Fall? Yes, but very gradually at first, so long as our speed was fairly well maintained. The airplane, as you know, will only buoy up on the condition that we move, and that pretty quickly. Still, there are always two spare steering screws to fall back upon. But what if they stopped as well? It's most unlikely that they would stop. The three shafts are worked independently, but if they did, the sand valves would have to be opened. The sand valves? Yes. You have doubtless been surprised at the huge size of the Attila. While the main parts of the upper and middle portions of her hull are nothing more or less than a succession of gas meters, of compartments filled with hydrogen introduced at a high temperature so as to yield the maximum amount of buoyancy. Below these compartments again lie the sand reservoirs. When these latter are three parts full, their natural effect is to keep the Attila at about the level of the sea, supposing that is to say that the screws are completely stopped. If your so much dreaded event was to happen, the watch in the conning tower would simply shift the sand levers, a quantity of ballast would be released, and we would at once begin to rise. We can thus regulate our weight at will. The secret of it all is the marvelous lightness of these walls. I am not free to tell you to what discovery that lightness is due, but you may test and analyze as much as you like on the off chance of a correct guess. It's superb, is my enthusiastic comment. But how about an ordinary complete descent to Earth? Very simple matter. From the outer gallery, the Attila looks as if her bottom was gently curved, terminating in the customary orthodox keel. That is what the upper line suggests. But 3 feet below the level at which we stand lies a flat projecting bottom studded underneath with springs resting on the axles of wheels. I wish to touch land. I press certain knobs, and this, that, perhaps all three screws ease off, running down or maybe reversed. The Attila then sweeps onward much after the fashion of an albatross, with outspread motionless wings. Steering is easy. A ting in the engine room sets this or that side screw shaft rotating. Slowly, perhaps fast, she falls, then faster and faster. Meanwhile, I stand by the sand levers. I pull this and the stern rises. We swoop down like a hawk. I pull that, the bow rises. The impetus thus gained carries the Attila in a noble curve aloft. Finally, she hovers over the ground, and opening a hydrogen valve, I adjust her descent delicately so as to spare the springs. But you must lose a great deal of hydrogen in this matter. Not as much as you would think. And besides, loss is of no moment. We carry an immense quantity of the gas compressed in tubes at a pressure of many thousand pounds to the square inch. What loss there is can therefore always be made good at intervals. You will have a chance of watching our procedure very shortly, as we stand up and replenish three or four gas reservoirs at a sand dune not very far distant. We passed the gaily lit passage back to the well, where for 50 feet above us the long stair curled upward to the citadel. These side walls, observed Hartman, with those constituting the outer skin of the Attila, bound the huge gas compartments I mentioned. They are independent, so that the serious accidents are impossible. In the cavities and corridors between them lie the cabins and quarters of the crew, the courts enclosed by which you must have noticed from the upper deck. All these courts open onto the outer gallery and communicate by the deck with the common room. To the center divisions of the ship, the engine room and the conning tower, no one has access except with my leave. This, he opened a small, carefully guarded door, is the magazine. He pressed a button and the gleam of a vacuum lamp pierced the darkness. Half awestruck, I stepped within.
There is nothing to see now. We have to be so cautious. Stay. Look here. He seized a ring and lifted the trap in the floor. I started back, for it opened into a well some 3 feet deep and then into the aerial abyss below. That well will vomit disaster one day. He let down the trap, and we left the gloomy chamber. The Attila, you see, Mr. Stanley, combines the advantages of the bird and the balloon, of the aeronef and the aerostat. It has been my dream from my boyhood, and at last, after infinite pains, it is realized. Still, even for me, it is but a means to an end, but you will admit it is not a bad one. We ascended at the stairway and stepped onto the upper deck. Some 20 men were assembled, and they respectfully saluted my companion. Comrades, he said, my friend Stanley comes among you. Though he is not yet one of us, he may be. His devotion to the cause of labor is his passport. Take him and treat him as our guest. He bowed to me and retired into his citadel. The crew crowded eagerly round me with the warmth wholly unlooked for. The terrible captain had evidently not spoken in vain. During the next half hour, I was escorted round their quarters in state. Naturally, I volunteered my services for the necessary work of the vessel, but somewhat to my surprise was firmly asked to desist. A guest, they said, could not be expected to conform to their habits at once, and two of the objectors were urgent in entreating me to accept their services. At the end, I was vanquished, not entirely to my regret, and the first day of my sojourn on the Attila passed pleasantly enough. Would that the others had passed in a like manner, for in that case, I should have to describe an Elysium instead of an Inferno. Chapter 8. A Strange Voyage. Released for the moment from care, I gave myself up to full enjoyment of the voyage. Of the grandeur of the cloud pictures, the glory of the sunsets and the twilights, of the moonlight flooding our deck as we sped over streaky mists below, of the mystic passage by night and the blushes of early morn, I cannot trust myself to speak. Such things ordinarily belittle words, but framed in the romance of this voyage, they wrought indescribable effects upon me. The economist was merged in the artist. I no longer reasoned, but lay bathed in the flood of feeling. And not only these beauties enthralled me, but the motion of the Attila was itself a poem. Have you never, in the drowsy noon of a long summer's day, lain back on the sward, watching the evolutions of a rook round its elm, noted the rapturous poise of its wings and the easy grace of its flight? Even such was the flight of the Attila. Let me detail an incident which took place overnight, and the ground for my enthusiasm will be obvious. Hartman had summoned me to his study, taken me along to the conning tower, the passage to which ran under the deck from the citadel. The tower, capped with searchlight apparatus for night work when requisite, rested on the nozzle or ram-like projecting bow of the aeronef, and was so constructed as to command a superb outlook. Two men were on watch when we arrived, and these respectfully saluted the captain. Is the shore far off? About 5 miles. Any vessels in sight? No, sir. All right. Now, Mr. Stanley, he said, turning to me, I am going to show you how the Attila obeys its master. We require to load up with sand and refill 5 or 6 of the hydrogen compartments. That strip yonder is one of our favorite docks. Watch me. He pressed one of the knobs communicating with the engine room. That stops the force supply to the main shaft, the revolutions of which will speedily ease down. We're falling fast. Do you observe? Hold tight. There! The bow dipped several degrees, and we shot onward and downward like an arrow. Were we rushing into the sea, the billows of which seemed to leap up at us larger and larger each second? Another pitch. The bow rose considerably, and we were carried by the aeroplane hundreds of yards upwards, the onward motion being at the same time inconceivably rapid. Once more these tactics were repeated, and so closely we neared the ocean that the waves must have splashed the screw blades. Meantime, Hartman rapidly twisted a wheel with each hand. This works the sand levers of the bow, that of the stern. Ballast is dropping quickly. At once we rose, and to my unconcealed wonder, stopped at a height of about 300 feet above sea level, still, however, riding forward with a lazy, careless motion. We were now near the sand pits, whither a few turns of the screw bore us gently. Hartman, watching the opportunity, began twisting a small wheel in the center of a medley of others. A hydrogen valve! We fell sharply, but a touch to the other wheels eased us, and alighting gently on the spit, the wheels of the Attila were buried up to their naves. It was then getting late, so everyone was at as expeditious as possible. First, bag after bag of sand was dried and cast in the sand reservoirs, binding the craft immovably to the dune, the process resembling a culling operation at port side, and amused me greatly. I worked hard and earned a shower of praises. Afterwards, I stood by while the huge center compartments were filled with the rarefied gas. It was a tedious affair because each in turn had to be pumped and repumped out, then filled with cold hydrogen, then with a fresh supply highly heated so as to contract and become rare on cooling. About 1 hour was consumed in the operation, and at its close the Attila still lay motionless on the sandspit.
everything, however, having been duly overhauled, the sound levers were gently worked, the surplus ballast slipped away, and breaking away from our couch, we floated 20 feet above to the spit. The three screws were then set rotating, and speed having been attained, we curved upwards into the bosom of the sunset clouds, an experience more superb romance itself could not furnish. Later on, we passed at high speed over Havre, the lights of which twinkled merrily through a mist patch. Next, Rowan glided away beneath us, and at seven, we swept over the gorgeous city of Paris. Satiated in some measure with these sights, I stepped down to a court and entered a cozy smoking room. Burnett was there, and Brandt, the philosopher whom Hardman had mentioned. I was very fond of German thought, and did not fail to improve the timely occasion. Brandt was not only a metaphysician, but readily listened to my very guarded criticisms of the anarchists. He was, however, inflexible, and professed to the most supreme confidence in Hartmann. He is the heart of the enterprise, and it was he who gave the Attila wings. Look at what he effected with small resources, and you may rely on him with great. He evinced a sturdy faith in the scheme of supervision, and prophesied as its result a grand moral and intellectual regeneration of man. But he added, the initial blows will be terrible. One remark filled me with apprehension. London, he said, in 3 days will be mere shambles with the roof ablaze. Heavens, I cried, so soon? Yes, the object of this trip is merely to sell details with some terrestrial friends who meet us tomorrow evening, delegates from the various affiliated bodies of Europe. Shortly afterwards, I had an interview with Hartmann and urged that some warning might at least be given to our friends. By all means, he remarked. Warn yours to keep away from London. One of the delegates will act for you after due inspections of the message. For myself, I have already taken my private precautions. Diary, Tuesday morning. Crossed Dijon and the River Saone in the night, rising rapidly as the slopes of the Jura Mountains are ahead of us, and the captain, as they call him, will insist on keeping high. No doubt it is safer, but I suspect the real truth is that he wants to appear unannounced over London. A portent as mysterious as terrible. Shows himself ironical and inflexible. I suggest a mild course of action, and he asks me whether I aspire to be the captain of the Attila. And becoming, nevertheless, almost inured to the thought of the impending calamity, Brandt says philosophically that the advance of man is always over thorns. Unhappily, the thorns do not always lead to happiness. Will they do so in this case? The bluster of the vulgar dynamitards is revolting. Even Burnett is forgetting the end is in the means. As to Schwartz, his vile parody is being sung freely by all the English-speaking hyenas of his stamp. The dynamite falls on castle walls and splendid buildings, old in story. The column shakes, the tyrant quakes, and the wild wreckage leaps in glory. Throw, comrades, throw, set the wild echoes flying. Throw, comrades, answer, wretches, dying, dying, dying. I'm getting to loathe the crew. Now the novelty of their reception is beginning to wear off. Tuesday, afternoon. Still higher, great discomfort being experienced. The barometer reading makes us 3.5 miles above sea level over the pine-covered summits of the Jura Mountains. I find it necessary to breathe much more rapidly. The rarity of the air is unsatisfying. At times a dizziness seizes me, and on examining my hands and body, I find my veins standing out like whipcord. Hartmann shortly eases off the screws. He was experimenting, so it appears, with his machinery. A change of tactics is observable. He ignores possible sightseers now, probably because he knows that reports from tourists and mountaineers stand no chance of being believed. Hence, we almost brush the mountains, and a superb privilege it is. The magnificent pines here surpass anything else of the kind. Sometimes we glide midway along a valley with a rushing torrent beneath us and these pine-fringed precipices on our sides. Sometimes we amaze a luckless mountaineer or shepherd as we thread a defile. Sometimes we curve over valley heads with a grace an eagle might imitate. Then again, we breast at the cloud rack and we are lost in its mantling fleeces. We are now bearing southeast by south and are not far off from the beautiful Lake of Geneva. Tuesday, night. Wrote letter and telegram and gave them to Hartmann for the delegate. We have stopped over the pine forest some 5 miles distant from Morges, on the shore of the lake. Switzerland, I am told, was selected as the rendezvous because of its central position. Many Russians, Poles, Austrians, and Italians, besides delegates from other nationalities, are expected. They are here to arrange details of the forthcoming revolution. Had a friendly talk with Burnett, who once more tried to proselytize me. Told him if anyone could shake my convictions, it is Hartmann and not he. How bloodthirsty the men are getting. Query, what if the lust for blood grows by what it feeds on? What if this crew gets out of hand? Happily, a strong man stands at the helm. Later.
The convention is in full swing. What enthusiasm must inspire these tourists, for, of course, it is in this character that they travel. Most, I hear, are very badly off, their funds being supplied by their associations. A great deal of provisions and materiel have been brought aboard. How well this crusade is organized! Hartman remains on board. He has never left the vessel except on the occasion when he visited his mother. Burnett and Schwartz take his instructions to the delegates, and most of the crew escort them. We are floating very near the ground in a rude clearing on the mountainside. Two rope ladders and some cables link us with the soil. After several hours' conference below, the delegates visit the Attila. Heavens, what desperados some look! Yet they control, so Burnett says, vast societies. Hartman interviews each. He works patiently through the list and finally addresses them en masse, launching terms of the most animated invective against modern civilization. Am, of course, excluded, but learn that everything has gone off admirably. Five of the delegates are to join the crew, the rest carry back their instructions. We start early in the morning. What a spectacle there is before us! However, 2 days' breathing time is something. Trust that delegate, whoever he is, will not forget the telegram and letter to Lena.